Centertainment Talk Radio on the web at www.centertainment.org. I'm Joe Davidson. Thank you so much for joining us today. And if this is your first time listening, be sure to sign up for the newsletter, which is free. And all these podcast episodes are free and available to you on the show page at centertainment.org. Today, we're talking about compassion and self-love. You know, I was curious about how Webster, the dictionary, defines this word, and I looked it up. It said compassion, a feeling of wanting to help someone who is sick, hungry, in trouble, sympathetic with another person's distress with a desire to alleviate it. Today, my guest is Ashok Gupta, and I'm so excited to have him back again. You can find out more about his work at www.guptaprogram.com, and that's spelled G-U-P-T-A, P-R-O-G-R-A-M-M-E.com. So, hi, Ashok. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi there, Joe. It's great to be here.
Well, maybe you're listening to this show right now, and you're realizing, like me, I'm hard on myself, and you realize that you can be very hard on yourself. Can you be as compassionate to yourself as you are to other people, especially when you make mistakes, big or small, or you know, wish that you'd done something different in the past? Sometimes we get stuck in that. And sometimes I know for myself, the biggest bully is not really somebody else, but it's that voice inside of my head. So Ashok, I wondered, what has your own healing and your experience taught you about compassion for yourself and also for others?
Well, I think for me, it's been a journey of self-discovery. And I think we're all on that journey ourselves in terms of understanding why in the past I was hard on myself. And certainly, if people know my story, I suffered from chronic fatigue syndrome and ME when I was younger, when I was at university. And part of it was the severe stress and pressure I used to put on myself to perform, to feel good enough, to try and alleviate some kind of inner lack of contentment or satisfaction that I was experiencing. And that really was a turning point for me to realize that I was hard on myself. I was someone who had this inner critic that would put myself down and criticize things that I was doing, but it was very unconscious, and I wasn't aware that that's what I was doing to myself. So that's certainly, you know, been, you know, my initial experiences of understanding this voice inside and how to begin to approach it.
I think it's amazing you talk about performance. Could you bring that up a little bit, the connection between people who are perfectionist, and you know, I've had that because I am a performer, so I think I was very, very hard on myself, and and I wasn't really aware of how hard I was even being on myself while it was happening. But there's this thing with perfectionism, and then compassion comes in. How does that change us?
Perfectionism says, I'm only good enough if I achieve ridiculously high standards that I've set for myself. Compassion says, I'm good enough regardless of what I achieve or don't achieve. They're diametric opposites. Yeah. So perfectionism is the diametric opposite of compassion for oneself, because perfectionism is attempting to achieve a standard that is implausible, is very unlikely that you're going to be able to achieve that level of perfection, because nothing, you know, in our relative world, nothing is perfect. It's very difficult for something to be perfect.
I was thinking about sports. You see it on the court. You also see it in the business world, where coaches or leaders use criticism to motivate players. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the difference between constructive criticism and destructive criticism.
Yes. Destructive criticism is that criticism which makes someone feel less worthy. Yep. So when it actually hits a nerve within us and makes us feel even lower about ourselves. Constructive criticism is that criticism which inspires us to be better. And I think, you know, in the business world, they talk about whenever you're going to give feedback to someone, start off with something positive. So you're giving someone feedback, start with the positives first, build up their sense of worthiness, that you respect them, that you appreciate their good talents, and then say, and something else I want to give feedback on is, in the future, maybe you could do this, maybe you could do that. So it's giving people feedback that, yes, you know, they maybe have underperformed in certain areas, but giving them solutions and inspiring them to be better rather than saying, you know, rather than being far too negative on people. We do have to develop a stronger backbone to be able to handle criticism, to handle feedback, and not take it personally. Yeah. But at the same time, the person who's giving the feedback, also, there are more constructive ways of giving feedback rather than pure criticism. Now, there are some situations where actually people need a kick up the bum, as it were, where there are some types of feedback that do require a bit of assertiveness, you know, a slight bit of anger to say, come on, you know, you need to do something about this. And anyone who's a parent will know that with their children, you can give constructive feedback, you can be very loving and compassionate, but sometimes in certain occasions, something stronger is required to be able to really give that shock that people need to kind of wake up to what they're doing to themselves. The nature of our uncontrolled minds is to focus on the negative. So if we've had 99 compliments but one criticism, our mind will zone in on the criticism because we're always looking at the next layer of self-improvement, the next layer of approval from others around us. And when we're aware of that, then we can smile at our minds and say, okay, my mind's thinking and obsessing about that one criticism, but that's okay because that is the nature of the mind. And what I can do is to begin to be more compassionate with my mind and accept my mind for doing that and understand why the mind does that. And when if we just observe our minds with compassion and understanding, then it no longer affects us because we are not, therefore, then our minds. We can feel our minds getting upset and tense, and that's when we're involved too much in our minds. But we take a step back and we take a deep breath in and we breathe out and we observe our minds with amusement, almost with amazement. Wow, look at my mind. How interesting my mind is that I've had 99 positive things, but this one thing it's obsessing about. I'm so curious to understand how my mind would behave like this. How interesting. You're doing it with compassion and, you know, it's like tongue-in-cheek awareness that is just the nature of the mind. And that takes 50% of the sting out of that criticism. It's just that amusement. Right. So it's three A's: awareness, amusement, amazement.
Well, one of the things that your program is great for is bringing in levels of emotional awareness. And I think many people doing the program already have a great deal of emotional awareness, but a lot of people get more, or for some people, it's a kind of a new adventure to go on. So I think it's really great to be aware of that and approval seeking. You know, when you really get into that and you start noticing those really subtle ways that, like, you know, why am I doing this thing I'm about to do right now? What am I wanting from the other person that I'm contacting or helping or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And then that all really ties in with compassion and self-love too, because when you're super strong in compassion for yourself and in self-love, I mean, this is a lifelong process. It's not like I have this all figured out. I work on it all the time. But yeah, you start doing less of that and you start becoming more aware, like the curious observer, aware of, oh, I just did that.
In some ways, it's lifelong work, but at the same time, we can understand that there are ways that we can accelerate that process. And, you know, there are three main personality traits that tend to come from a lack of self-love, which we talk about in the program, which are, you know, the achiever. So I feel a sense of lack of love, so let me achieve more. The helper, which is, well, I feel a sense of lack of love, so let me help others, and by doing that, I will receive love, so let me put other people's needs first. And the third one is the approval seeker, where let me work to gain the approval and people please, so the people around me, and in that way, then I will gain approval. And there are many other personality traits which ultimately come from this core sense of inadequacy that we all have inside us. And just to take a step back, I thought it'd be useful just to, you know, I have a kind of theory as to where all of this comes from and how it works, which I think is quite useful if we take a step back. Generally, when we're growing up, as children, we're in the most vulnerable phase because we can't survive on our own and we rely on our parents to look after us, both physically, you know, materially, and emotionally. And as we grow up, if as a child we perceive that our parents or one parent is not taking enough care of us, then we begin to develop a lot of fear around that. And that can be whether a parent, we perceive, and remember, this is all about perception. Yeah? Now, there are obviously cases where parents are neglectful, are hurtful, are abusive. So there are lots of, so it's it's about what our parents are doing, but also our perception of what they're doing as well. It's a combination of both. And during those phases, we may begin to develop certain fears and negativity. So that it develops in three stages, where the first stage is the perception of a lack of love or a lack of nurture. And often that perception is, recent research is showing, it's related to controlling or overbearing parents is one type of parenting where that can occur, or whether this kind of abusive parenting, or people who are neglectful is another type of parenting. And the second phase is the conditioning, where if we experience that repeatedly again and again and again, we start taking on the experience and even some of the ghost voices of our parents. It starts, that inner voice is actually a ghost voice of our parents or caregiver, or it could even be teachers or relatives. It's not just our parents involved in the conditioning. And the third phase is then strategies. So we come up with strategies to offset that feeling of lack of love. Okay, so we've got first stage of perception of a lack of love in childhood. Second is the conditioning phase, where we repeatedly train ourselves to believe that and incorporate those particular voices inside ourselves. And the third phase is then strategies to overcome that inherent sense of lack of love. And three strategies that we've just talked about are achiever, helper, and approval seeker. So ultimately, all that's actually happened is there's a frightened child within us. There's literally a personality trait within us. It's living within us, which is stuck at the developmental age of a child. And as we go through life, we are mature adults, and yet when a situation comes up which might trigger a sense of lack of love, that inner child will then take over and make us behave in a certain way which may not be useful for our health or well-being, in order for that inner child to offset that perception of lack of love. So in the sense of achiever, we may work really long hours and push ourselves too hard to feel better about ourselves. With a helper, we may look to put other people's needs first and then become resentful that we're not being looked after. Or people pleaser, we may constantly feel on edge because we're worried about what other people think of us. So all of these personality traits are an attempt to, our inner child's attempt to overcome a lack of self-love.
And I think one of the important things too to kind of emphasize, at least this is my understanding, is there's nothing wrong with being a helper. That's a great quality. It's a great quality to be an achiever and have your own business or in the arts or whatever you're doing. It's more about the energy that's behind, I guess, what's fueling you toward that.
You're absolutely right. And for those people who are interested, if you want to find out more, the Enneagram process talks about some of these personality traits. And you have a scale, I believe, from 0 to 10, where 0 is a kind of low-functioning achiever and 10 is a high-functioning achiever, in the sense that you've offset the negative aspects of that personality trait and you've been able to embrace the positive aspects.
I wanted to say something really quick to it, that just about parenting, because sometimes when I hear the stories, and there's a lot of people out there who had pretty rough childhoods, and you can see how these patterns get set up. I also wanted to share from a different perspective. I actually had a really good childhood and very close to my parents, and I felt loved, and I still ended up dealing with some things. You know, and some of my actually most traumatic events happened after childhood.
Absolutely. We can develop these traits after childhood. What we're saying is that the first 10 years of childhood sets up our baseline and is the most important factor. But I've certainly helped people who in their 20s have had a really bad set of failed relationships, which have hit them hard, or have lost a business or gone bankrupt, which has then severely affected their sense of self-esteem and self-love. And they've been traumatic periods in their lives. So absolutely, it's not just childhood. I agree.
There are times when a lot of emotions come up that are really uncomfortable as you're processing things. And we want to move really fast through them so that we can get into that happy place. And sometimes there's stuff to work through. And Ashok, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how to be compassionate with the painful emotions we feel.
Yes. When we experience painful emotions, there are generally two strategies we come up with. One is to push it away and repress it. And the ways that we will do that is through alcohol, through distraction, through putting our mind on something else, over consumption of media, television. It's all a way of distracting ourselves away from those core emotions, and therefore we repress them. The other way that we deal with it is to indulge them. So the pain comes up, and we think, oh, yes, I've had such a bad experience. Oh, yes, I feel so horrible about myself. And when we indulge those emotions, that also becomes a difficulty where we then can develop anxiety and depression. So anxiety and depression are a result of either repressing the emotion or indulging the emotion too much. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And actually, a safer way and a more compassionate way that we can deal with these difficult, painful memories, difficult, painful emotions, is a deep sense of acceptance and forgiveness. Now, what do we mean by that? When an emotion comes up, is to deeply accept ourselves for having that emotion. The worst thing that people do, sometimes I observe, is they tell themselves off for having that emotion. You know, oh, I should be bigger than this. Oh, why am I feeling bad about that person? Why am I angry at this person? You know, it's a deep sense of acceptance and compassion for yourself for having that emotion. It's okay. There's nothing wrong with you. Allow the emotion to come up. And then the most important thing is neither to repress it or to indulge it, but to be the compassionate witness of what is unfolding within your mind. To meditate, to breathe slowly and deeply as you allow these emotions to be exhausted out of your system. And so that mindful awareness of emotions is very important. And then secondly, I think it is very useful to work with a coach or, you know, or a therapist to help have an external compassionate observer. Because if we're not compassionate with ourselves, if we have someone external who can hold us in that space of compassion, then that can also be a positive way of handling and releasing our emotions of the past and our traumas of the past.
So how do you feel them? Because they are being felt. How do you feel them and allow yourself to do that? And at the same time, sort of be observing of them, which to me means being a little bit outside of them? Or do you really just feel them and just go through it, and sometimes they don't magically just disappear? You know, you think, oh, I'll feel it to heal it, but all you do is feel it.
Yes, and that's the thing. There is, in psychotherapy, there's this interesting idea that actually if we just bring up our memories of the past, and some people stay in, you know, whatever, psychotherapy for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. If we just talk about the past and bring up all of that, magically it will also dissolve. And it's a really lovely, interesting idea, but in my experience, it's not always quite the truth. So there are two stages. One is allowing ourselves to bring up those emotions which are being repressed and haven't been resolved. And then secondly, doing something with them. Yeah, having a strategy for how things are going to move forward and change. In my experience, the first step is actively doing exercises where you forgive the actors in the past. So who are the actors that have been involved in these traumas and hurts of the past and the pain? And if you can't forgive, can you release? So we don't say you must forgive. It's about releasing if you don't feel ready to forgive. But then that is the next step onto forgiveness. So forgiving the actors of our past for what they have done. And when we actively do that through an active process of forgiveness, that helps reduce and release some of the pain. The second very powerful technique is that inner child technique of actually realizing that we have this inner child, an actual part of us within us, that exists. And when we compassionately and regularly speak to that inner child as a wise, loving adult, we're able to soothe and allow that child to process those emotions and release those emotions, because now there's a compassionate, wise adult looking after that child within us.
You said active process of forgiveness, and they might want to know, well, what do you mean by that? What is that? What steps do I do? How do I do it?
Okay, well, this is something where it is useful to work with a coach. So I don't want to actively, I would encourage people to work with a coach because it can bring up difficult emotions. But in that process, and I tend to do this process in a very deep, relaxed state, sometimes within hypnotherapy, a hypnotic state, where we get someone to actually bring up the emotions that they're experiencing that haven't been expressed before. And typically it might be a deep sense of anger or hurt or betrayal towards a caregiver, a parent, a teacher, a sibling. And they bring up that emotion as much as possible. So that's why it has to be in a safe, compassionate environment with a coach. And then release that towards the person to whom they're angry. So generally, there's a child within us that is holding on to pain and feels hard done by, but wasn't able as a child to express that, because you wouldn't want to express that anger towards the very person on whom you depend. So there's a process of actively releasing those raw emotions of anger to that person in your mind. Mm-hmm. And once you do that, people feel a deep sense of relief that all this pain they've been hanging onto inside that couldn't come out has now been safely released towards that person. And often in my clinic, people will be shouting, they'll be screaming, they'll be crying, but it's a very cathartic process. Once they've released that anger, only then can they be ready for the next stage, which is an active process of forgiveness. And that's where we go through a gestalt dialogue, where they actually speak to that person and say, look, this is how you made me feel, but I've released that now, I've released my anger, and I understand why you behaved the way you did. I understand that you had your own troubles. I understand that your parents treated you like that, and that's the only way you thought was best to be able to treat me, and I understand that. So it's going through a process of understanding where that person was coming from and why they made us feel that way. And then the next step, if a person is ready, is that forgiveness. And that's an active process of deeply breathing in, and as you breathe out, feeling and imagining that sense of forgiveness for that person in every cell of your body. And this process can take a number of sessions, step by step, to go through a process of releasing the past anger, developing a conversation and an understanding of where that person was coming from that made us feel like that, and then finally being ready to forgive. It's a very cathartic process and a beautiful process to watch.
That's amazing. Yeah, that sounds beautiful. Well, how, for people who are doing your program, how can they work with this? Sometimes people get a little bit confused about when they're doing the steps and they're saying stop. It's like they're kind of stopping and blocking the experience of going through something emotional that they need to go through.
Yes, and I can clear that up. The stop is for repetitive negative thoughts which are going around and around and around. So the stop is designed as an interruption technique. But when we're experiencing difficult emotions, the stop is not necessarily designed in that way. When we've got those difficult emotions, then we do spend some time reflecting on those difficult emotions. And we also can do a soften and flow process, which is closing our eyes, observing where that emotion physically is stuck in our body, and just breathing slowly and deeply, saying soften and flow, which is a way of just softening the intensity of those emotions within us and observing them like a curious observer with compassion. So the stop is designed for busy thoughts where we're just, you know, they're just going around and around, but not for these types of emotions.
In the field of medicine, and even in holistic medicine, even in this, you know, I've met doctors and various leaders who see themselves as whole and their patients as broken, but they themselves are unaware of the darkness that's within them or the wholeness in the people that they're working with. And there's a quote that I love so much from Pema Chodron that says, compassion is not a relationship between the healer and the wounded. It's a relationship between equals. Only when we know our own darkness well can we be present with the darkness of others. Compassion becomes real when we recognize our shared humanity. Isn't that the most beautiful quote?
It's very beautiful. It's very beautiful. And this is something where when someone is becoming a coach or a therapist, it's very important, and many courses do this, where people become aware of their own shadows, their own negativities that lurk within them, their own patterns. Because if we don't, then we can't fully be present with someone and fully help them through their journey, because the empathy will not be there.
Right.
And so I agree with this idea that when we're working with someone, it's not like we are, the therapist or the coach is the expert and the perfectly formed person who's now going to help the broken person through their issues. No, the person who's the coach or the therapist is someone who is allowing a space of presence to be created for a sense of sharing and wisdom to be developed within both people, because even the coach and therapist is constantly learning,
right,
as they go through this journey, just as much as the client is. I won't say patient, but the client is. So it's a shared mutual journey of self-discovery, and it should be seen as that. For sure.
Yeah, we really, I think, often do teach the things that we're learning. It's kind of this, it goes both ways, you know. It's like I'm always the student and I'm always the teacher at the same time, and then the student very much so, and then the teacher. It goes back and forth. And I think we all have that in us, you know, and we can all learn from each other so much. We all make mistakes. We all have our successes. And so it's surrounding all that in compassion and love for ourselves and for each other, and trying to treat each other as we would want to be treated, which we all fall short of. If the whole world did that, it would be a different place for sure.
It would. And something that's just on what you said there, some people might say, well, you know, how do we spot that? How do we know we're working with someone that imbibes those values? And the core thing that we should look out for is humility. That when we're working with someone, do we feel like they are trying to fix me, or, you know, they know all the answers and whatever? But, or do we see that there is a genuine compassion and humility there, and it's a journey that they want to take with us,
exactly,
rather than being the expert?
Well, sometimes people think they have to be really hard on themselves in order to reach their goals. Is there a way to bring compassion and love into that process?
Yes. So I think we can take a step back and look at our motivations. So most people think that actually when we're hard on ourselves, that's the way we can motivate people. But once again, this is a ghost habit from our past, maybe from our childhood, our teens, wherever, where someone in our lives thought that by being hard on us, it would motivate us to do better. And interestingly, this is a trait that I see in many families, and it's very much more in Eastern families as well, although that's beginning to change as well. And it's recognizing that whereas that is one way of motivating ourselves, which is to be hard on ourselves, pull ourselves down so we can pick ourselves up and do better, actually, it's not a happy way of being productive. It may or may not work, but it certainly isn't a happy way of living life, because life's too short to be achieving purely, you know, without the happiness that comes with it, without enjoying the journey. And so we can recognize that and say, actually, there's a way of inspiring and motivating ourselves without putting ourselves down. And the way that we can do that is focus on new motivations. And rather than looking at life as a way of filling in the gap within us, we can instead, you know, have a motivation to be excellent at what we do. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Or it might be that we look to help others through our work. We look to serve our clients or our customers in the best way possible by performing at a higher level. Mm-hmm. Or we may see it as beneficial to our team or the company that we're working with. So when we do something which is outside our own personal vested interest, then we expand the circle of compassion and motivation, and then we are no longer so hard on ourselves, because it isn't what's in it for me right now. How is my ego going to benefit from this performance, which causes stress, depression, negativity, and doesn't really help the gap that we feel inside, because we can fill that gap temporarily, but it never works.
Right.
So, by focusing on the expanded motivation, how is this uplifting my life, the people around me, my community, my society, and linking it to that, then we are able to transcend that limited ego that we have within us.
I used to think life was black and white, you know, a long, long time ago, and I was more drawn to black and whites and extremes, but there's gray, and that's what's in all of us. And it's like they say, there's a saint in every sinner and a sinner in every saint, you know, that phrase.
Yeah.
And it's like when you have made mistakes yourself, I think it gives you enormous compassion for others, because you can see the goodness in others and the goodness in yourself, that you are not those mistakes.
That idea of mistakes is, you brought onto that. That's a very important lesson that we all learn in life, which is that it is our fear of failure, our fear of making mistakes, that holds us back and limits us. Whereas actually on our journey, we are bound to make mistakes. If we haven't made mistakes, then we haven't really pushed ourselves. We haven't really inspired ourselves to be the best that we can be. And so it's a deep acceptance of mistakes and a deep acceptance of ourselves when things don't go the way that we want. And if we look in, you know, we were talking about achievers. Actually, if we look at who society remembers, if we look at great people from the past, we tend to idolize and remember the people who were of service to society. You know, we don't idolize the people who became fabulously wealthy and rich and self-absorbed. We remember people like Gandhi and Nelson Mandela and Abraham Lincoln and people who were inspired for a bigger and better cause, who served humanity at a higher level. And so we think that only those kinds of leaders are people who, you know, are these big, great leaders who help the world. But in our own community, in our own families, in our own societies, we are those types of compassionate leaders who serve and come from that place of service instead of what's in it for me. And when we do that, the fragile ego suddenly realizes, hang on a minute, now we're not working to try and fill this gap. We're not working to try and make me feel better about myself, which never works. Now we're working for the collective good. And that sense of separation, that sense of ego, gradually dissolves. And that is a magical process. So it's all about changing our motivations in life. And when we just go ahead and do that, then our ego follows and dissolves, and we become more connected to those around us.
I love that line, changing our motivations, changing our motivations. That's everything right there. And when you change the motivation and you come from a place that's really that good center, you know your worth, you're not doing out of anything to prove anything, you're not doing it because you need love that you're not getting, you know your worth, and you're standing strong in that, I think that's a beautiful thing. And your motivation actually relaxes you, and then you can do the same things you used to do, but you're doing them in a new way so that it's not, you know, triggering the nervous system and the fight or flight centers of the brain.
Exactly. And I think the interest is, you mentioned the fight or flight. Actually, some people might look at this and think, well, no, you know, if I work from that perspective, then my rivals are going to get that promotion because they're going to be more eager to get the promotion and whatever. In my experience, when you change your way of processing your work life, processing your career, you become better at what you do. Because when you look at how I can serve my customers better, how I can serve my clients better, how I can work my team better, you remove the stress, which compromises your, you know, your performance, and you perform better. And, you know, companies talk a lot about customer-orientated performance and working for our clients. There's a reason behind that, because when we make that a focus for our at an individual level and at a team level, then we become better than we could have been. We become bigger than the sum of our parts. And that idea, that principle, is something that I sum up in the ABCD. So whether we're acting in the world and we're worried about our performance and we are feeling insecure, we simply go through the ABCD of how we can work in the world. So A is, I accept the results of my actions. So I accept whatever's going to happen, good or bad, whether I perform, don't perform, I accept everything. B is for beingness. So as I perform, I keep my mind centered and be in the moment and enjoy the journey and connect with those around me rather than worrying about the outcome. C is for compassionately serving. So I show compassion for my team, my customers, my clients, and I look at how I can serve them with humility. And D is for dedication. And D is where all of my actions at some level are dedicated to something bigger than just myself. And so for some people, that will be a figure from their religion or spirituality. So some people dedicate their lives and their actions to Jesus or to Buddha or to Krishna or whomever. Other people, that's a dedication to life in general, to a life force or the universe, or dedicating their actions to their families. And so when we go through those A, B, C, and D, whenever we're feeling stressed, we will find that we then realize that we are not this limited ego, and our nervous system just relaxes when we remember those four concepts and work with those four concepts regularly.
I read an article by Dacher Keltner. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, but he's an author anyway, and he's a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. And he wrote that compassion is essential to our evolutionary history. It defines who we are as a species, and it serves our greatest needs as individuals to survive and to connect. And he mentioned an interesting study that I wanted to bring up. I thought it was kind of fascinating. Undergraduates basically were shown images that were intended to inspire pride. So something like a school mascot, you know, this is our team, this is our school. And the study found that the more pride they felt, the weaker the vagus nerve response. And Datcher said he was astounded by this. And he said what it shows basically is that when you feel a strong vagus nerve response, a strong one, that means you're feeling common humanity with many different groups. But when we're encouraged to feel a strong identification with just our own group and not others, the vagus nerve dims. And he said, we've also found that people who have a strong vagus nerve connection have more positive emotion on a daily basis, stronger relationships with peers, better social support networks, and fifth graders who had a stronger vagal profile are the kids who intervene when a kid is being bullied. And that goes right into compassion. So you're not neutral when someone's being oppressed or abused. You're not neutral, you intervene.
With each all of us is this search for connection, a sense of belongingness. And if we just say, right, I belong to my family, you know, I feel a sense of belongingness to my family, then we've narrowed that circle of compassion. But when we expand that and say, actually, I feel that with my, you know, friends at school and the entire school, or actually it's my responsibility to look after people in this entire school, then we start expanding that circle of compassion and we naturally become more stress-free because we're taking responsibility for a bigger area, a bigger set of people and circumstances. And so that sense of connection, the wider and wider we can create that connection, the better. And an example of this is, at the ultimate level, they say that there's nothing more powerful in the universe than a mother's love. And the way that a mother feels towards her child is the intense peak of belongingness. It really is a sense of connection and oneness with their baby, with their child. And, okay, it might be tricky for us to develop that with, you know, the entire of humanity, but it's possible. It's a journey that we're on to really feel stronger and stronger senses of connections and belongingness to people around us and expanding that circle until we expand that to the entire human race. And if we all thought like that, if we all thought like that we are one cell in this body that has an important role to play to keep the entire body alive, then we would reduce our need for what's in it for me and self-gratification, but we'd be working for the entire collective. Just like an individual blood cell has an important job to do and it carries the oxygen around our bodies. But if that blood cell said, hey, what's in it for me? Why you know, why am I spending all this time delivering, iron around this body? Then the whole system gets affected. And so that idea that we can reduce our sense of stress and anxiety and worry by helping others, feeling that sense of connection and belongingness to those around us, it's a practical knowledge that we can employ right now in our lives.
I wanted to bring up a quote. Now, this is more geared towards women, but, you know, men have things as well. But Glamour magazine, let's just talk about self-love for a moment. Glamour magazine did a study, and they found that 93% of women have a cruel thought about their body every day.
Within men and women, there are certain aspects of our personalities which are slightly different. And certainly for women, the way that there is more of a sense of dependency on how they look and how society and other people around them will respond to how they look. So there's a more of a focus on that. Whereas with men, their focus is more on, it can be with women as well, but with men, they will worry about how they look, but their focus is more on their achievements and how they've compared to their peers in terms of their achievements, you know, wealth, status, etc. And so, it is a shocking statistic that 93% of women are having a negative thought about themselves. Once again, the way that we approach that is to observe, to acknowledge and accept that that is a part of us. There is a part of us within us that is critical of how we look, critical of our bodies and our body shapes. The modern media and society and magazines magnifies that particular effect. So it makes it far worse, especially when we're flicking through magazines with airbrush models, and every model on the catwalk is a size 0 or a size 2, and it's just it's living up to an unrealistic expectation of what we think society now sees as attractive. And remember, there have been societies where actually being a more rounded full figure was seen as far more attractive than a thin figure. So there's no objective thing here. It's all about what the perception is of society and people around us. And so it's very important that we observe these thoughts within us with, once again, that awareness, amusement, amazement, that there is this part of me, even though I'm a beautiful person, there is a part of me that has this negative thought, and I accept and acknowledge that this part is within me, and I now look to re-educate this part of me. And that's where we can treat that negative thought like an inner child and have a conversation with that part of it, saying, hey, I know you just had that negative thought, but actually, you know, I feel really good and confident and positive about my body and my image, and I don't want to go down those negative thought patterns. And when we develop that regular conversation with that negative part of us, it can begin to dissolve and not be such a pressure on us. Because we are seeing increases now in anorexia and bulimia. And one of the reasons is that with social media and media in general, we're seeing so many more body images around us, and we're comparing ourselves to those people. For instance, I saw a recent survey saying that a third of teenage girls had self-harmed.
Wow.
And so that's massively increasing, just because we're feeling this, we're fueling this unhappiness within women about their body shape, about how they compare to their peers. And things like Facebook and social media are magnifying the effect of this. So we have to be very careful how we tread with these new tools that are relatively new to society, and we don't really know how to use them.
Well, speaking of new tools that are new to society, Photoshop and airbrushing, a little bit of that, fine, but a lot of the magazines actually are doing extreme levels of it, and a lot of times teenage girls aren't really aware of the huge differences in the pictures between what that person actually looks like. And they're beautiful, you know, it's like you don't have to, you know, go that far to edit and Photoshop and do all that stuff. Well, it's an amazing subject. You know, if any of you listening are interested, feel free to email me because I have a beautiful link to something that Louise Hay did. It was one of her talks that is all about self-love, and I think it's really great. So you can email me. My email address is jodavidson@mac.com. So Ashok, I'm just so overwhelmed by this wonderful information, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be here. Is there anything else that you wanted to really get in and add for people?
Yes, I think that if we look at the entire field of self-development, in my experience, and this is a journey that even I'm on and we're all on, developing deep levels of self-love and self-compassion, self-acceptance, and contentment with who we are is the most important thing we can do on the self-development path. It's absolutely core. And I would even go as far as to say that most of the problems that we see in the world, at their root, they are down to a lack of self-love or a sense of, you know, ego and separation with people around us. If we look at a lot of the despots around the world, the corruption, the megalomania, the wars, a lot of it is being driven unconsciously by leaders who've got a deep sense of lack of love and are using war, land grabs, separation of communities and societies as a way unconsciously of making themselves feel better about themselves rather than opening the circle of compassion. So this sense of self-love at individual level, at society level, and at global level is the most important gift that we can give ourselves.
In any line of work, when you're seeking to help other people, if that practice of doing that becomes something that's merely an extension of your ego to build yourself up, then you got to step back. You got to step back because you're not doing it out of self-love. You're doing it out of more greed. And, you know, we've all had times in our life when we can get into that, like, kind of power stuff a little bit. Whoa, 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 step way back. Because that's not going to lead you to anything that's real or lasting, because those values are not lasting.
Exactly. And once again, that phrase that you picked up on, motivations. What is my motivation?
Yeah.
And when we look at our minds with amusement and amazement, we suddenly realize, hey, 90% of the stuff I'm doing every day, whether it's, as you've mentioned here, wanting to become a coach or therapist, or the new car I've bought, or the party I'm putting on, if we observe our motivations, a lot of it is coming from a place of, please love me. I want everyone around to be approving of me and think how amazing and great I am, you know? And when we observe our motivations, then we can take a step back and say, hang on, that is only going, it's never going to work, first of all. So the strategy of trying to fill the gap from the outside never works, because you become addicted to it. And so I need to take a step back and shift and change my motivations for the things that I'm doing in life. And then we become happier beings.
Thank you so, so much for joining us. This has just been a beautiful episode, and I'm sure it's going to help so many people. I really appreciate you being here.
No, thank you so much, Jay. It's been great.
You've all been listening to Zentertainment Talk Radio on the web at zentertainment.org. I'm Joe Davidson, and I hope you have a great week. We'll catch you next time.